This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The New York hush money trial of Donald Trump closes at its second week. What has the public and the jury learned so far? Plus, student protests about Gaza spread as Columbia University appears to push back a deadline for the encampment there to disperse. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Mene Ukwe-Barua. We are in the middle of the fourth day of arguments and testimony as we tape this in the trial of Donald Trump in Manhattan, but to my eye, still pretty far afield from the 34 felonies for falsifying business records that are the basis of the case. Most of this week has been taken up by a witness for the prosecution, National Enquirer media impresario David Pecker, who was not a party to the payoff of Stormy Daniels in 2016 that is the basis for the charges against Trump. Let's listen to a clip of Donald Trump at the courthouse today speaking about the testimony that happened yesterday.
Yesterday went very well in this courthouse. It should be over. The case is over. You heard what was said, and the case should be over. But you'll have to make that determination. I think we have a judge who will never allow this case to be over in a positive way. He's highly conflicted, the most highly conflicted judge I've ever seen.
Kim, your column this week is on the Trump trial. What is the argument that you're making?
The argument that I'm making is that the prosecutors going after Trump right now seem to be extremely confused, maybe potentially a bit worried about the lack of credibility of these charges, and so now are increasingly throwing a lot of very serious sounding words around, only they're not connected to the actual charges that Donald Trump has been hit with in this trial. So if you would listen to the prosecutors on the stand, remember, what we have here is Donald Trump has been charged with numerous counts of falsifying business records having to do with a payment that was made to Stormy Daniels, a hush money payment that was made by his lawyer, Michael Cohen, in which Donald Trump later paid him back. So the underlying crimes or the falsification of business records. But to turn that into a felony, again, Alvin Bragg had to suggest that it was with the intent of committing or concealing another crime. And there's a number of theories that the prosecuting team have presented to the judge about that. The number one theory that they have presented is that the bigger crime was that Michael Cohen, in making this payment, engaged in an illegal campaign contribution by breaking limits from campaign finance laws. But none of that has really been the issue of this case, certainly not so far. In that what we're hearing from the prosecutors is Donald Trump engaged in a conspiracy and election fraud and election interference. And the idea seems to be that by concealing the information from the public about his so-called affair with an adult film star, that somehow he was materially withholding information that could have made a difference in the election. And my column is pointing about, first of all, the great dangers of suggesting that campaign finance laws no longer exist to just simply show who donated to whom so that we can keep track of potential, for instance, bribes or influence. That's really the idea behind campaign finance laws. But rather now that we can use them to compel people to reveal private and personal information that some prosecutor feels is relevant to an election. And when they fail to do that, and if money was used to either engage in that concealment, et cetera, that somehow that is a violation of campaign finance laws is absolutely nuts and very, very terrifying. I mean, you have to wonder what the limiting principle of that would be. And that's sort of one of the things that's been coming out of this is just they're throwing everything they can up on the wall to see what sticks. But I don't think the people have really stopped to consider what kind of ramifications were to come if that line of thinking were to hold true. It would wrap an enormous amount of new information that prosecutors got to decide whether or not a candidate had an obligation to reveal it to the public.
The point Kim is making about the wide-ranging rhetoric that the prosecution is using, I think, is a very good one. That is something that has struck me as well. The court is releasing transcripts on a rolling basis, but they're delayed by a couple days. But we do have the transcript of the opening arguments now on Monday. Let me read the opening argument by Prosecutor Matthew Colangelo. Here's a piece of what he says. It was election fraud, pure and simple. We will never know, and it doesn't matter if this conspiracy was the difference maker in a close election, but you will see evidence in the defendant's own words from his social media posts, from his speeches at campaign rallies and other events. You will see in his own words, making crystal clear that he was certainly concerned about how all of this could hurt his standing with voters and with female voters in particular. And Monet, he went on to cite a text message from the lawyer representing Stormy Daniels in this hush money payment. And apparently, according to this opening argument, when it became clear on election night that President Trump was going to win in 2016, Stormy Daniels' lawyer texted, quote, "What have we done?" unquote. And what I think is so remarkable about that is there is all sorts of language being used here. He said conspiracy over and over again. He said election fraud. And President Trump is not charged with conspiracy. He is not charged with election fraud. He is charged with misstating the repayment for this Stormy Daniels hush money in 2017 in invoices and in company books and in checks that he gave to Michael Cohen in 2017. And so it's strange to me, Monet, that we are not talking here about 2017. We are talking here about things that happened in 2016 before the election. And he's getting extremely close to making an argument to the jury in Manhattan, which voted 87% for Hillary Clinton in 2016, that this was the difference maker and that President Trump, you know, got pretty close to stealing the election.
Right. Well, there's no doubt at this point that that's exactly Alvin Bragg's strategy. He knows that the specific charges being mounted against Trump are difficult to prove. The idea that Michael Cohen was contributing to the campaign and that that was being misrepresented in the books will depend on a lot of subjective testimony from witnesses. And it seems as if the Trump team is prepared to bring people to the stand who will suggest that this was not a deliberate concealment or misrepresentation, at least by Donald Trump, of something that was understood to be an election contribution. And even if they could prove that, it will be very difficult to convince the jurors that this is a federal election interference type of crime. And so they really think that they need to cast a pall over the broader charges and suggest that this is something that affected the outcome of the election, that this was improper behavior, skullduggery of a kind, and that it had an influence on the outcome of the election because, again, they know that they're dealing with a pool who's likely to be skeptical of Donald Trump and feel as if they have a role in correcting misdeeds in the 2016 election, regardless of who's right or who's wrong on the very abstruse details of how Michael Cohen's reimbursement was booked. I do think that it's interesting that the Trump defense is somehow being pushed into playing on the terms that Bragg is setting. If you look at the cross-examination of David Pecker, you did see Emil Bove, who's one of Trump's lawyers, basically trying to push back on the idea that Pecker has done similar catch-and-kill deals, getting information about public figures and suppressing them in the past, and was trying to make sure that jurors understood that this is a normal part of how the business is sometimes done and doesn't necessarily mean that Pecker was acting as an agent for the Trump campaign. And all of that may be true and could be contextually important for the jurors to understand. But it's interesting that, as far as I know, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, Kyle, the defense didn't come out and say, this is all completely completely irrelevant. It seems as if they understand that even though this doesn't have to do with the legal merits of the case being brought against Trump, we still have to defend Trump's conduct on some of these instances and try to dispel the importance of how it might have played in the election, because we know that that's how the jurors are ultimately going to vote, even if that's not what they're supposed to be considering. And so it really should be up to the judge, Juan Merchan, to set the ground rules here and to rein in the prosecution when they're going so far afield of what their duty should be, which is to prove the charges that have actually been brought against Trump. But it seems as if the field on which this case is being fought, it has been broadened, and Trump has to actually contest against Bragg's approach, regardless of the fact that it's very irrelevant to the law.
Hang tight. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back. To my mind, the testimony of David Pecker is interesting in a couple ways, and we don't have the transcripts for many of these days, so I'm going to refer to some live blogging of the trial from the Washington Post. It seems to me, Kim, that the prosecution's argument is the kind of quote-unquote catch-and-kill deals that we're talking about here with Stormy Daniels, and then with other people who had made allegations about Donald Trump, that those were in effect campaign donations. And so a couple points that the prosecution was trying to hit home. One is that according to David Pecker, again, the National Enquirer executive, these agreements were done in order to help Trump politically and to avoid problems before the election. Again, according to the testimony of Pecker, Trump did not mention his wife in any of these discussions, that he was trying to keep these alleged affairs quiet because he didn't want to upset Melania. On the other hand, the defense is digging into other kinds of deals that David Pecker was also party to, as Manet alluded to earlier. Here's one piece from the Washington Post blog. It says that Pecker said he worked with Donald Trump as far back as 1998, even before he took over the tabloid publication. In 1998, he became aware of a negative story the Enquirer was working on about Marla Maples, Trump's second wife, and alerted Trump to it. Pecker said he also tried to kill the story, but wasn't in charge then, and the story appeared. And so obviously he had a long-standing relationship with Donald Trump and was doing this kind of thing long before Trump was an announced presidential candidate in 2015. And again, as Manet alludes to, he also said he did similar sort of things for other public figures, including Arnold Schwarzenegger, including Rahm Emanuel. Here again is from the Washington Post blog. After Rahm Emanuel left the Obama White House in 2009 and began a campaign for mayor, the Enquirer learned of allegations that Emanuel had an affair. Pecker testified, "You did help suppress that story," the defense attorney asked. "I did," Pecker said. "You acquired the rights." "I did," Pecker answered, "with the intention of not making that story public." "Yes," Pecker replied. And so, Kim, to me, this cuts against the idea that people at the National Enquirer and people within the Trump organization, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump himself, were thinking of this behavior as secret campaign donations that they were trying to cover up.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a feeling that this line of questioning and the decision to bring Pecker to the stand is going to really backfire on Alvin Bragg in the end. Why is he up there? All right. Fundamentally, the prosecution wanted to maybe embarrass Donald Trump, certainly present him in a seamy light, but to suggest that this was done, that there were conversations somehow, and that this entirely backed up their argument that Donald Trump was highly worried about these potential stories from these women influencing or affecting his ability to become president. And that is, you know, square in with their argument that this is somehow, therefore, the payments, a campaign donation. The problem, as you say, is here's what we found out from the National Enquirer, is that, as you note, they have been working with Donald Trump for years, long before he ever considered becoming a political candidate. And one of the problems Bragg has is that other cases that have been brought, most notably against John Edwards by federal prosecutors, and the argument that somehow payments to mistresses were some sort of material fact that the voters needed to know in campaign donations, they lost that case in court. And the problem that they faced is that campaign finance law, you know, makes clear that you can't count as a campaign donation something that has another purpose. In fact, you can get in trouble by using your campaign to give out money for things that arguably are of a personal nature. And one thing that's come out in the Pecker line of questioning is that there were many, many reasons that Donald Trump would not want this story out that had nothing whatsoever to do with his campaign. For one, he's a big time celebrity, has been for a long time, and celebrities care about their reputation. And in fact, the entire line of Pecker questioning about all of these other stars show the lengths to which many of them work with tabloids, et cetera, to try to manage and groom that public perception of them out there. The other, obviously, is marital relations and Melania or his family. You might not want this out for that reason. I think this really undercuts, if you've got a jury that's paying attention to what the kind of real law is here and the problems that the defense is going to point out in the holes here, I think this could be very, very damaging to them. Also, just as an aside, it has been incredibly amusing to know that Alvin Bragg has called this guy up to the stand, and literally celebrities around the world are wincing every time David Pecker opens his mouth and reveals a little bit more about his involvement with their lives.
One of the difficulties, though, for the defense is that whether this is a campaign donation under federal law is ultimately a question of federal law. And I don't know, Manet, how much they can bring into this jury trial arguments that it is not a campaign donation, or if that has to wait for the eventual appeal. But that does raise the prospect that what we might end up with here, if we get a jury that convicts Donald Trump, is a kind of appeal to the federal courts eventually that this jury trial was misunderstanding the campaign finance rules that are actually in effect. And as Kim says, if this is a campaign donation to have this kind of agreement, what about a candidate who has a business interest and settles a lawsuit against his business in the run-up to the campaign because he thinks that that's a good time to do it? Because if he settles, he will avoid awkward questions on the campaign trail. Don't you have this lawsuit against you, sir? What about the allegations in this lawsuit? But I don't think that converts the settlement into a campaign settlement that should be made with campaign money instead of the money from the business.
Right. The prospect of a federal court appeal is almost certain if there is a conviction in this case. And looking at the merits, you'd think that the Trump team would have a very strong argument to make, and it'd be very difficult for a federal judge in the Southern District to fail to overturn on those grounds. I think one question is the timeline. Obviously, we have probably about 4 weeks or so until we would get a verdict in this case. And so the Trump team behind the scenes is probably already preparing their briefs for the eventual appeal. And it'll be a massive campaign and election episode how quickly that it is taken up by the courts, whether they stay the conviction and any penalty that Trump would face as a consequence of that, and how quickly it ends up being resolved. But it does seem as if the biggest issues at stake in the case right now are those federal questions, which are not going to be dealt with, at least not fully, in the New York courtroom right now. And so there's massive stakes hanging on whether or not Trump is convicted, of course, but I think audiences should know that they're going to have to stay tuned, because this is almost certainly going to be sent up the pipeline and litigated in federal courts as the campaign continues to play out.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's do an update on the spreading campus protests against Israel. After 100 people were arrested at the University of Southern California, USC has now canceled its commencement ceremony. And at the encampment at Columbia University in New York City, where some of this had begun, the administration gave protesters a midnight Thursday deadline to disperse and seems now to have pushed that. Here's the update from administrators at 11 p.m. It says the talks have shown progress and we are continuing as planned. University senators have been in dialogue with student organizers to discuss the basis for dismantling the encampment. A formal process is underway and continues. And then it says this, Kim, there's a rumor that the NYPD has been invited to campus this evening. This rumor is false. And so my understanding is, as we're taping this on Friday, the encampment is still there. Maybe the formal process that was described there, negotiations are still underway, Kim.
Yeah, we don't know. We're going to have to watch this as it unfolds. But I think there's going to become a moment here. It does not look as though any of these kids that are out there are going to disband without a requirement that they do so, which may well involve the police. And I appreciate that there are negotiations going on, but even as those are happening, these are swelling, they're getting larger, and they're getting rowdier as well, too. You know, we're having more instances of confrontations because that's what happens when you have large crowds and when tempers are running at high levels. So we're going to see what they do to take care of this. But what's becoming incredibly clear is that campuses that did not deal with this and nip it in the bud when it first started and just made clear that this kind of behavior is not going to be tolerated on the campus and that those who engage in it actually will be subject to quite severe consequences. This is the natural outcropping of that. And we're now having, you know, the University of Southern California just announced that they were canceling their entire commencement address. And I appreciate that there are some additional issues there at USC about their commencement speaker that was asked not to speak, et cetera. But there's a lot of kids that are on that campus that have no stake in this or not interested in this, who have spent 4 years working hard on a degree, and their parents are not going to be able to come and see them graduate at this point. And it's really just appalling that these administrators are so focused on the kind of rabble in the middle of their campus and how to treat this gently that they are ignoring the real responsibility of their university, its mission, and the kids that have remained faithful to it.
Let's take a couple letters from listeners on this topic. First, Ron says, one easy way for the administrators to consider how they should develop their speech codes or how to respond to intimidating or non-peaceful protests is to hypothetically swap out the causes. For example, if the protesters were a group of neo-Nazis or KKK members and they were harassing or intimidating certain groups of students, how would the university respond? How would they interpret their speech codes? What free speech guarantees would they want to ensure are protected? It's hard to imagine the answer would be the same as what they're currently implementing. That is some food for thought. And then here is Chad, who says, one of you said that limiting protesters' speech wasn't a First Amendment issue, but I'm afraid that's not true. When I was working on my degree, we had a hate preacher who would set up in the square at the center of campus and essentially heckle anyone who passed by. I talked to the administrators about it, and they informed me that because they take students who were there on government-backed student loans, they were required to allow him to set up and spew his hateful rhetoric. And Manet, my understanding is that the First Amendment is content neutral, but that it does allow restrictions on time, place, and manner of speakers is the phrase that you sometimes hear in the constitutional literature. And so my understanding is what that means is that if a public university allows person A and person B to set up a soapbox on the quad between certain hours, then this kind of hate preacher can do the same. But I think that what's happening at Columbia is different because I think the administration's position is that it has rules like no camping overnight on the quad might be one, and that the protesters in the encampment is not following the rules that have been set out, which are content neutral and apply to all protesters, no matter what their cause is. So when the NYPD was initially called in, here is what the president of Columbia said. She said Columbia had adjusted its policies on protest, and the current encampment violates all of the new policies, severely disrupts campus life, and creates a harassing and intimidating environment for many of our students, unquote. So Manet, my understanding is that Colombia, whatever the results of this kind of negotiation, it seems odd to me that you're having a negotiation with people who are breaking your rules and disrupting your campus life and the orderly operation of your university. But be that as it may, whatever the result of these negotiations, Colombia is within its rights and within the First Amendment to clear this encampment from its campus so that the regular business of the university can continue.
Well, without a doubt, the time, place, and manner restrictions on protesting are well established. And in the case of Colombia, a private university or even a public university, they have within their own charters or within their own rules as universities, certain restrictions on exactly what protesters have to do in order to be allowed. They have to register usually to be able to take part in a protest. They have to be confined to certain areas. And generally, it has to be within a certain period of time, and it can't disrupt the ordinary ongoings of campus life, not to talk of going out of their way to harass and threaten students and leading classes to have to be made remote for the remainder of the year. And so they've gone way beyond what the general restrictions are on what a protest protected by the First Amendment would be. And Colombia is very much within its rights to call in the NYPD to help to restrain and end those protests. To Chad's question about the hate preacher, I would ask, was that preacher there day after day after day? Was he disrupting students from being able to go to class or merely advertising a hateful, obnoxious opinion, but doing so in a way that was much more limited? And I think that that is a big contrast between a lot of the protests that we've historically seen and tolerated and the ones that we see on campuses today in which law enforcement's being called in. And I think generally these universities have made a very bad bet in thinking that when this current wave of protests popped up, that it would fizzle in the same way that the first round right after October 7th did. They knew that they were disruptive. They knew they couldn't go on forever, but they were hoping that they'd go away without them having to actually use any force to clear them out. But as Kim mentioned, the longer they've let them go on, they've really made it hard to make the argument that they're doing this for good and clear reasons, and they've shown themselves to be very weak. And now it's going to be perhaps a much uglier and longer process to clear them ultimately. And we can only hope that that will be a lesson to nip these sorts of things in the bud before they become entrenched when we see future disruptive protests of this kind.
Thank you, Manet and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.